ever attempted in the industrial world. As an interesting aside, Henry Ford apparently embarked upon the most foolish thing ever attempted in the industrial world, partly under the influence of the highly idealistic philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson, and in particular his essay Compensation. However, not being oppressed by the tyranny of the ore, Ford also embarked on this path with full recognition that workers earning $5 a day combined with lower car prices would lead to greater sales of Model Ts. Pragmatism? Idealism? Yes. Merck, Sony, and Ford each offer a different slice of a general pattern, the existence of core values and a purpose beyond profits as primary elements in the historical development of visionary companies. Like the fundamental ideals of a great nation, church, school, or any other enduring institution, a core guiding philosophy in a visionary company is a set of basic precepts that plant a fixed stake in the ground. This is who we are. This is what we stand for. This is what we're all about. Like the guiding principles embodied in the American Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, and echoed 87 years later in the Gettysburg Address, a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Core ideology is so fundamental to the institution that it changes seldom, if ever. In some cases, like Sony, the core values and purpose derive from the founding roots. In some cases, like Merck, they come from the second generation. In other cases, like Ford, they went dormant and were rekindled in later years. But in nearly all cases, we found evidence that core values and a purpose beyond profit existed not merely as words, but as a vital shaping force. In short, we did not find maximized shareholder wealth or profit maximization as a dominant driving force or primary objective through the history of most of the visionary companies. Indeed, for many of the visionary companies, business has historically been more than an economic activity, more than just a way to make money. Through the history of most of the visionary companies, we saw a core ideology that transcended purely economic considerations. And, this is the key point, they have had a core ideology to a greater degree than the comparison companies in our study. A detailed pair-by-pair analysis showed that the visionary companies have generally been more ideologically driven and less purely profit-driven than the comparison companies in 17 out of the 18 pairs. This is one of the clearest differences we found between the visionary and comparison companies. Of course, we're not saying that the visionary companies have been uninterested in profitability or long-term shareholder wealth. Notice that we say that they are more than economic entities, not other than. Yes, they pursue profits, and yes, they pursue broader, more meaningful ideals. Profit maximization does not rule, but the visionary companies pursue their aims profitably. They do both. Profitability is a necessary condition for existence and a means to more important ends, but it is not the end in itself for many of the visionary companies. Profit is like oxygen, food, water, and blood for the body. They are not the point of life, but without them, there is no life. Here are a few key examples of how the visionary companies, across a range of industries in our study, embrace the genius of the and, ideology and profits to a greater degree than their comparison counterparts. Hewlett-Packard versus Texas Instruments. Put yourself in the shoes of David Packard on March 8, 1960. Your company sold stock to the public for the first time 3 years earlier. The electronics revolution has launched your company into an explosive growth trajectory. You've been wrestling with all the challenges of rapid growth, but you're particularly concerned about HP's ability to develop highly competent, homegrown managerial talent. You believe in a promote-from-within policy as a key element of your ticking clock. You've therefore initiated an HP management development program, a program that you could consider central to the long-term health of the organization, and you're about to give a kickoff talk to the group of HP people responsible for the program. You want to imprint on their minds a key message to use as a guiding theme as they develop programs to socialize and train generation after generation of HP managers. What should be the theme of your talk? What message do you want these trainers to remember? After a short preliminary welcome, Packard began his talk. I want to discuss why a company exists in the first place. In other words, why are we here? I think many people assume, wrongly, that a company exists simply to make money. While this is an important result of a company's existence, we have to go deeper and find the real reasons for our being. As we investigate this, we inevitably come to the conclusion that a group of people get together and exist as an institution that we call a company so that they are able to accomplish something collectively that they could not accomplish separately. They make a contribution to society, a phrase which sounds trite but is fundamental. You can look around in the general business world and still see people who are interested in money and nothing else. But the underlying drives come largely from a desire to do something else, to make a product, to give a service, generally to do something which is of value. So with that in mind, let us discuss why the Hewlett-Packard Company exists. The real reason for our existence is that we provide something which is unique, that makes a contribution. Those who worked with David Packard describe his management style as practical, no nonsense, with a let's roll up our sleeves and get down to work attitude. He studied to be an engineer in college, not a philosophy professor. Nonetheless, we see David Packard ruminating about what we can best describe as corporate existentialism, pondering about the philosophical, non-economic reasons for being of his company. Profit, according to Packard, is not the proper end and aim of management. It is what makes all of the proper ends and aims possible. David Packard perfectly exemplified the genius of the end by explicitly embracing the tension between profit and purpose beyond profit. On the one hand, he made it crystal clear that the Hewlett-Packard Company should be managed first and foremost to make a contribution to society, and that our main task is to design, develop, and manufacture the finest electronic equipment for the advancement of science and the welfare of humanity. Yet, on the other hand, he made it equally clear that because profit enables HP to pursue these broader aims, anyone who cannot accept profit as one of the most important objectives of this company has no place, either now or in the future, on the management team of this company. Tough words. In comparing Texas Instruments with Hewlett-Packard, we reviewed over 40 historical articles and case studies and found not one single statement that TI exists for reasons beyond making money. Such a statement might exist, but we found no evidence of it. Instead, TI appeared to define itself exclusively in terms of size, growth, and profitability, but very little on what David Packard called the why of business. In 1949, TI's president, Pat Hagerty, issued his dictum for TI. "We are a good little company. Now we must become a good big company." This obsessive focus on size and growth, and very little on the why, has persisted throughout TI's history. To be fair, we found similar financial goals in a few of the visionary companies, in particular Walmart. But TI, unlike most of the visionary companies, and certainly unlike HP, appeared to make financial sales goals the driving force and put much less emphasis on the why of it all. As we're recording this new edition of the audiobook in 2004, HP has struggled considerably in the previous few years. We believe that part of HP's struggle has been a move to focus more on growth and scale and less on technical contribution. Whether HP returns as one of the great companies of the 21st century depends in part on whether it returns in full force to a passionate dedication to the genius of the end, an allegiance to its more idealistic principles combined with a pragmatic drive to build a powerful economic engine. Johnson & Johnson versus Bristol-Myers. When Robert W. Johnson founded Johnson & Johnson in 1886, he did so with the idealistic aim to alleviate pain and disease. By 1908, he'd expanded this into a business ideology that placed service to customers and concern for employees ahead of returns to shareholders. In 1935, Robert W. Johnson, Jr. echoed these sentiments in a philosophy that he called enlightened self-interest, wherein service to customers comes first, service to employees and management second, and service to stockholders last. Later, in 1943, he added service to community to the list, still ahead of service to shareholders, and codified the J&J ideology into our credo, printed on old-style parchment and captioned in the same lettering used in the American Declaration of Independence. When these things have been done, he wrote, the stockholders should receive a fair return. Although J&J has periodically reviewed and slightly revised the wording of the credo since 1943, the essential ideology, the hierarchy of responsibilities descending from customers down to shareholders, and the explicit emphasis on a fair return rather than maximum return, has remained consistent throughout the history of the credo. In the early 1980s, Chief Executive Jim Burke, who estimated that he spent fully 40% of his time as CEO communicating the credo throughout the company, described the interplay between the credo and profits. All of our management is geared to profit on a day-to-day basis. That's part of the business of being in business. But too often, in this and other businesses, people are inclined to think, we'd better do this because if we don't, it's going to show up on the figures over the short term. This document, the credo, allows them to say, wait a minute, I don't have to do that. The management has told me that they're interested in me operating under this set of principles, so I won't. At Bristol Myers, we found a much less ideologically guided company relative to Johnson & Johnson. Whereas J&J formalized and published its credo in the early 1940s and had a clear sense of its ideology dating back to the early 1900s, we found no evidence whatsoever that Bristol Myers had anything analogous to the credo until 1987, when it published the Bristol Myers Pledge, which looks suspiciously like a paraphrased version of the J&J credo. Nor did we find any evidence that the pledge, once stated, became anywhere near as pervasive a guiding document in Bristol Myers. Whereas J&J employees spoke explicitly about the link between the credo and key decisions, we found no similar comments by Bristol Myers employees. J&J used the credo as the basis for its response to the 1982 Tylenol crisis, when the deaths of 7 people in the Chicago area revealed that someone, not an employee, had tampered with Tylenol bottles, lacing them with cyanide. J&J immediately removed all Tylenol capsules from the entire U.S. market, even though the deaths occurred only in the Chicago area, at an estimated cost of $100 million, and mounted a 2,500-person communication effort to alert the public and deal with the problem. The Washington Post wrote that Johnson & Johnson has succeeded in portraying itself to the public as a company willing to do what's right, regardless of cost. Within days of the Tylenol crisis, Bristol Myers faced an almost identical problem. Excedrin tablets had been tampered with in the Denver area. Instead of recalling all tablets from the entire U.S. market, as J&J had done, Bristol Myers recalled tablets only from Colorado and did not launch a campaign to alert the public. Bristol Myers chairman Richard Gelb, who described himself as a cautious manager who likes to count things down to the last bean, was quick to emphasize in Dunn's Business Month that the Excedrin incident would have a negligible effect on Bristol Myers' earnings. J&J had a codified ideology in place that guided its response to the crisis, for better or worse, whereas the evidence suggests that Bristol Myers lacked a similar guidepost. Philip Morris versus R.J. Reynolds. Even at Philip Morris, relative to R.J. Reynolds, we found evidence of the company framing its work within the context of an ideology rather than just maximizing shareholder wealth. Ross Millhiser, vice chairman of Philip Morris in 1979, said, "I love cigarettes. It's one of the things that makes life really worth living. Cigarettes supply some desire, some aspect of the fundamental human equation. The human equation is always trying to balance itself, and cigarettes play some part in that." Ideology or self-delusion? Merely good PR? It's impossible to tell. But we saw in Philip Morris an esprit de corps and sense of common purpose that we simply did not see over the last 30 years at R.J. Reynolds. Philip Morris executives have appeared far more passionate about their cigarettes than the executives at R.J. Reynolds. They express much more defiance in their pro-smoking ideology, whereas the RJR folks, after about 1960, did not seem to care much about the products except as a way to make money. According to the R.J. Reynolds chairman in 1971, if the company could make more money for shareholders by getting out of cigarettes, then fine. Unlike Millhiser, he had no ideological allegiance to tobacco. The Philip Morris executives, in contrast, framed the fight over cigarettes in almost self-righteous moral overtones. We have a right to smoke. It's a matter of freedom of choice. Don't take away our cigarettes. Don't tread on me. In our review of articles on Philip Morris, we noticed numerous photos of executives taking a rebellious pose, cigarettes in hand, glaring into the camera with a manner that conveys, "Don't even think about asking me to put down this cigarette." A Fortune magazine article noted, "An almost defiant smoking culture permeates the executive floors, whose denizens yank from the pockets flip-top boxes, light up, and then toss their packs on the desk or table for all to see." It's as if they actually see themselves as the lone, fiercely independent cowboy depicted in their all-pervasive Marlboro billboards. An ex-Philip Morris employee described working at Philip Morris as the cult of smoking and told us that the company forced upon her and her co-workers boxes of cigarettes to take home with their paychecks. A Philip Morris board member told us, while fingering a box of filter tips, "I really love being on the board of Philip Morris. It's a really great company. I mean a great company. It's like being part of something really special. It's a company that stands for something, and being part of it is something you can really be proud of." A Forbes article said of Philip Morris chairman Joseph Kullman in 1971, "A good many people resent Kullman for his aggressive defense of cigarette smoking. Instead of apologizing for cigarettes, he points to the beneficial effects of smoking in the area of mental health." Please don't misinterpret us. We don't see Philip Morris as working altruistically for the good of humankind. The ideology at Philip Morris relates primarily to personal freedom of choice, individual initiative and hard work, merit-based opportunity, winning, and continuous self-improvement, earning the pride that comes from simply doing business extraordinarily well and ever better for its own sake. Michael Miles, who became Philip Morris' chief executive in 1991, and whom Fortune magazine described as a business junkie, pragmatic, ruthless, focused, cold-blooded, who thinks about business every minute of his life, commented, "I see nothing morally wrong with the tobacco business. I see nothing wrong with selling people products they don't need. These are not particularly soft or humanistic values, and cigarettes, after all, don't cure river blindness." But, and this may surprise you because it surprised us, we found that Philip Morris shares with Merck an esprit de corps that is linked to a strong core ideology. To be sure, Philip Morris's ideology differs dramatically from Merck's, but both companies stand above their comparisons in the study in the extent to which they are ideologically guided. Along this key dimension, Philip Morris has had more in common with Merck over the past 40 years than it has had in common with R.J. Reynolds, and Merck has had more in common with Philip Morris than it has had in common with Pfizer. The fact that both Merck and Philip Morris, companies at opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of what their products do to people, show up as visionary companies guided by strong yet radically different ideologies raises some interesting questions. Is there a right core ideology for being a visionary company? Does the content of the ideology matter? Are there any common elements or prevalent patterns across the core ideologies in the visionary companies? We compiled the core ideologies of the visionary companies in our study and found that, although certain themes show up in a number of the visionary companies, for example, contribution, integrity, respect for the individual employee, service to the customer, being on the creative or leading edge, responsibility to the community, no single item shows up consistently across all the visionary companies. Some companies, such as Johnson & Johnson and Walmart, made their customers central to their ideology. Others, such as Sony and Ford, did not. Some companies, such as HP and Marriott, made concern for their employees central to their ideologies. Others, such as Nordstrom and Disney, did not. Some companies, such as Ford and Disney, made their products or services central to their core ideology. Others, such as IBM and Citicorp, did not. Some companies, such as Motorola and 3M, made innovation central to their ideology. Others, such as P&G and American Express, did not. In short, we did not find any specific ideological content essential to being a visionary company. Our research indicates that the authenticity of the ideology and the extent to which a company attains consistent alignment with the ideology counts more than the content of the ideology. In other words, It doesn't matter whether or not you like or agree with a Philip Morris ideology, not unless you work for Philip Morris. Nor does it matter whether outsiders agree with Merck's ideology, or Marriott's, or Motorola's, or Disney's, or HP's. We concluded that the critical issue is not whether a company has the right core ideology or a likable core ideology, but rather whether it has a core ideology, likable or not, that gives guidance and inspiration to people inside that company. How can we be sure that the core ideologies of highly visionary companies represent more than just a bunch of nice-sounding platitudes? Words with no bite. Words meant merely to pacify, manipulate, or mislead. We have two answers. First, social psychology research strongly indicates that when people publicly espouse a particular point of view, they become much more likely to behave consistent with that point of view, even if they did not previously hold that point of view. In other words, the very act of stating a core ideology, which the visionary companies have done to a far greater degree than the comparison companies, influences behavior towards consistency with that ideology. Second, and most important, the visionary companies don't merely declare an ideology, they also take steps to make the ideology pervasive throughout the organization and transcend any individual leader, as we will describe in future chapters. Certainly, the visionary companies have not always found it easy to maintain and live up to their ideologies. Jack Welch of GE describes the difficulty of living with the tension between pragmatism and idealism, or what he calls numbers and values. Numbers and values. We don't have the final answer here, at least I don't. People who make the numbers and share our values go onward and upward. People who miss the numbers and share our values get a second chance. People with no values and no numbers, easy call. The problem is with those who make the numbers but don't share the values. We try to persuade them. We wrestle with them. We agonize over these people. In fact, we did not find that the visionary companies have always been perfect exemplars of their ideologies. GE, for example, had a number of ethical and legal transgressions in the 1950s and 60s, including collusion in a scandalous bid-rigging scheme with other utility companies in 1955. Even Johnson & Johnson, with its famous credo, has struggled at times to keep its ideology alive and operating as a shaping force. In 1979, 36 years after Robert W. Johnson wrote the credo, J&J put itself through an extensive soul-searching process with respect to the credo. According to then-chief executive Jim Burke, "People like my predecessors believed in the credo with a passion, but the operating managers in 1979 were not universally committed to it. So I called a meeting of some 20 key executives and challenged them. I said, here's the credo. If you're not going to live by it, let's tear it off the wall. We either ought to commit to it or get rid of it." By the end of the session, the managers had gained a great deal of understanding about and enthusiasm for the beliefs in the credo. Subsequently, we met with small groups of J&J managers all over the world to challenge the credo. The visionary companies have not always been perfect, but as the J&J credo rededication effort and the GE agony over numbers and values illustrate, the visionary companies in general have placed great emphasis on having a core ideology and have put much effort into preserving the core ideology as a vital shaping force. And, again the key point, they have done so more than the comparison companies in our study. As we mentioned earlier in this chapter, the core guiding philosophy, the core ideology of a truly great company has two component parts: core values, a set of enduring tenets, and core purpose, a reason for being beyond just making money. Allow me to spend just a few minutes on each of these components. Core values. Thomas J. Watson Jr., former IBM chief executive, commented on the role of core values, what he calls beliefs, in his 1963 booklet, A Business and Its Beliefs. "I believe the real difference between success and failure in a corporation can very often be traced to the question of how well the organization brings out the great energies and talents of its people. What does it do to help these people find common cause with each other? And how can it sustain this common cause and sense of direction through the many changes which take place from one generation to another? I think the answer lies in the power of what we call beliefs and the appeal these beliefs have for its people. I firmly believe that any organization, in order to survive and achieve success, must have a sound set of beliefs on which it premises all its policies and actions. Next, I believe that the most important single factor in corporate success is faithful adherence to those beliefs. Beliefs must always come before policies, practices, and goals. The latter must always be altered if they are seen to violate fundamental beliefs. In most cases, a core value can be boiled down to a piercing simplicity that provides substantial guidance. Notice how Sam Walton captured the essence of Walmart's number one value. We put the customer ahead of everything else. If you're not serving the customer or supporting the folks who do, then we don't need you. Notice how James Gamble simply and elegantly stated P&G's core value of product quality and honest business. When you cannot make pure goods of full weight, go to something else that is honest, even if it is breaking stone. That's really what it's all about. The core value can be stated a number of different ways, yet it remains simple, clear, straightforward, and powerful. Visionary companies tend to have only a few core values, usually between 3 and 6. In fact, we found none of the visionary companies to have more than 6 core values, and most have less. And indeed, we should expect this, for only a few values can be truly core, values so fundamental and deeply held that they will change or be compromised seldom, if ever. Core values do not come from mimicking the values of other companies, even highly visionary companies. They do not come from following the dictates of outsiders. They do not come from reading management books, and they do not come from sterile intellectual exercises of calculating what values would be most pragmatic, most popular, or most profitable. When articulating and codifying core ideology, the key step is to capture what is authentically believed, not what other companies set as their values or what the outside world thinks the ideology should be. In a visionary company, the core values need no rational or external justification, nor do they sway with the trends and fads of the day, nor even do they shift in response to changing market conditions. Robert W. Johnson Jr. didn't write the Credo because of a conceptual theory that linked credos with profits or because he read it in a book somewhere. He wrote the Credo because the company embodied deeply held beliefs that he wanted to preserve. George Merck II deeply believed that medicine is for the patient, and he wanted every Merck person to share that belief. Thomas J. Watson Jr. described IBM's core values as bone deep in his father. As far as he was concerned, those values were the rules of life: to be preserved at all costs, to be commended to others, and to be followed conscientiously in one's business life. In sifting through the Hewlett-Packard Company archives, we came across the following statement by David Packard. In 1949, I attended a meeting of business leaders. I suggested at that meeting that management people had a responsibility beyond that of making a profit for their stockholders. I said that we had a responsibility to our employees to recognize their dignity as human beings and to assure that they should share in the success which their work made possible. I pointed out also that we had a responsibility to our customers and to the community at large as well. I was surprised and shocked that not a single person in that meeting agreed with me. While they were reasonably polite in their disagreement, it was quite evident they firmly believed I was not one of them, and obviously not qualified to manage an important enterprise. Hewlett, Packard, Merck, Johnson, and Watson didn't sit down and ask, "What business values would maximize our wealth?" or "What philosophy would look nice printed on glossy paper?" or "What beliefs would please the financial community?" No. They articulated what was inside them, what was in their gut, what was bone deep. It was as natural to them as breathing. It's not what they believed as much as how deeply they believed it. Purpose. Purpose is the set of fundamental reasons for a company's existence beyond just making money. When properly conceived, purpose is broad, fundamental, and enduring. A good purpose should serve to guide and inspire the organization for years, perhaps a century or more. P. Roy Vagelos, looking 100 years into the future, described the enduring role of purpose at Merck & Company. Imagine that all of us were suddenly transported to the year 2091. Much of our strategy and methods would have been changed by developments we cannot anticipate. But no matter what changes might have occurred in the company, I know we would find one thing had remained the same, and the thing that matters most: the spirit of Merck people. A century from now, I believe we would feel the same esprit de corps, I believe this above all because Merck's dedication to fighting disease, relieving suffering, and helping people is a righteous cause, one that inspires people to dream of doing great things. It is a timeless cause, and it will lead Merck people to great achievements during the next 100 years. Indeed, a visionary company continually pursues but never fully achieves or completes its purpose, like chasing the Earth's horizon or pursuing a guiding star. Walt Disney captured the enduring, never-completed nature of purpose when he commented, "Disneyland will never be completed as long as there is imagination left in the world." Disney can evolve from rinky-dink cartoons to full-length animated movies to the Mickey Mouse Club to Disneyland to box office hits to Euro Disney and to who knows what in the 21st century, yet never outgrow the core task of bringing happiness to millions. Sony can evolve from rice cookers and crude heating pads to tape recorders to transistor radios to Trinitron color TVs to VCRs to the Walkman to robotic systems and to who knows what in the 21st century, yet never finish pursuing its core purpose of experiencing the sheer joy of applied technological innovation that brings about untold pleasure and untold benefits and the elevation of the Japanese culture. In short, a visionary company can and usually does evolve into exciting new business areas, yet remain guided by its core purpose. Not all of the visionary companies began life with well-articulated core values and purpose. A few did. Robert W. Johnson, for example, had a sense of J&J's purpose from the moment he conceived the company, to alleviate pain and disease. So did Masato Ibuka of Sony when he wrote the company's 1946 prospectus. But others, like HP and Motorola, didn't pin down their ideology until after the company had solidly passed the initial startup phase, often a decade or so after founding, but usually before they became big companies. In the early stages, most visionary companies just tried to get off the ground and make a go of it, and their ideology became clear only as the company evolved. So if you haven't yet articulated a core ideology because you've been in the throes of getting your company going, that's okay. But the earlier the better. In fact, we encourage you to set aside the time to articulate your ideology now. In the final chapter of this audio reading, Building the Vision, I will lead you through some key steps and present a practical framework for how to get your values and purpose right.
Chapter 4. Preserve the Core, Stimulate Progress. In the previous chapter, we presented core ideology as an essential component of a visionary company. But core ideology alone, as important and really as exciting as it is, does not, indeed cannot, make a visionary company. A company can have the world's most deeply cherished and meaningful core ideology, but if it just sits still or refuses to change, the world's going to pass it by. As Sam Walton pointed out, you can't just keep doing what works one time, because everything around you is always changing. To succeed, you have to stay out in front of that change. Or as Tom Watson Jr. embedded as a huge caveat in his booklet, A Business and Its Beliefs, if an organization is to meet the challenges of a changing world, it must be prepared to change everything about itself, except its basic beliefs, as it moves through corporate life. The only sacred cow in an organization should be its basic philosophy of doing business. Jerry and I believe that IBM began to lose its stature as a visionary company in the late 1980s and early 90s, in part because it lost sight of Watson's incisive caveat. Nowhere in IBM's three basic beliefs do we see anything about white shirts or blue suits or specific policies, specific procedures, organizational hierarchies, mainframe computers, or computers at all for that matter. The real three key principles in IBM's core values were 1. Respect for the individual, 2. Dedication to the customer, and 3. The idea that IBM should seek superiority in everything it undertakes, and if it can't become superior at it, it should not do it. There's nothing in there that specifies that you need to wear white shirts and blue suits. Mainframe computers are not core values. Specific policies are not core values. IBM should have more vigorously changed everything about itself except its core values. Instead, it stuck too long to strategic and operating practices and cultural manifestations of the core values. We found that companies get in trouble by confusing their core ideology, their core values, and the specific non-core practices. By confusing what is core, the values and the purpose, and what is non-core, just merely practices and strategies and structures, companies can cling too long to non-core items, things that should be changed in order to adapt and move forward. This brings us to a crucial point in this entire book. A visionary company carefully preserves and protects its core ideology, its core values, and its core purpose. And yet, at the same time, all the specific manifestations of its core must be open for change and evolution. This is the cornerstone idea: preserve the core, stimulate progress. Let me just share with you a few examples to kind of crystallize this idea. Walmart's notion of exceeding customer expectations, that's a permanent, unchanging core value. The notion of customer greeters that you see at the front door, that's not a core value. That's just simply an operating practice. If it becomes useless, you can change it. Or let's take 3M. 3M's core principle of respect for individual creative initiative. Now, this is a permanent, unchanging part of its core philosophy. But the 15% rule, where people can spend 15% of their time on projects of their own choosing, that's simply a practice. It's a mechanism. It can change. Nordstrom's dedication to the ideal of service to the customer above all else, that's permanent. That's unchanging. That's a core value. On the other hand, its regional geographic focus, or its piano players in the lobby, its overstocked inventory management systems, these are all simply non-core practices that can change. If the values remain constant, Nordstrom remains great. If the practices change, Nordstrom remains great. Merck's fundamental driving ideal that we are in the business of preserving and improving human life, that's not going to change. Not if Merck remains a great company. That's unchanging. It's part of its core. It's its core purpose. Its commitment, on the other hand, to research targeted at specific diseases, well, that's a strategy. And if at some point they need a different strategy, like, say, buying biotech companies, well, the strategy can change while the core purpose remains fixed. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, pause and take this point in. It's absolutely essential to not confuse your core values and your core purpose with culture, strategy, tactics, operations, policies, or other non-core practices. Over time, your culture must change. Over time, your strategy has to evolve. Over time, the things you actually do, your product lines or your services must change, your goals must change, your competencies must change, your administrative policies must change, your organization structure must change, your reward systems must change. Ultimately, the only thing a company should not change over time is its core ideology. That is, if it wants to be a visionary company. And this brings us to the central concept of the book, that underlying dynamic of preserve the core and stimulate progress, that is the true DNA of a visionary company. I'd like you to picture a yin and yang symbol. And think of it as that on one side of the yin yang is the core philosophy, the core values, the core purpose, the core ideology, those kind of ideals and tenets. But on the other side of the yin yang, hand in hand with it, is a drive for progress. So you have on the one hand, core philosophy, core values, core purpose, core ideology. Think of core ideology as a single term that captures all of those ideas. And on the other hand, drive for progress. Core ideology works hand in hand with a relentless drive that impels change and forward movement in all that is not part of that core ideology. The drive for progress arises from a deep human urge to explore, to create, to discover, to achieve, to change, to improve. The drive for progress is not some sterile intellectual recognition that progress is healthy in a changing world, or that healthy organizations should change and improve, or that we should have goals. Rather, it is deep, it is inner, it is compulsive, it is almost primal, it is a drive. If you are not productively neurotic, you don't understand the drive for progress. It is the type of drive that led Sam Walton to spend time during the last few days of his life
discussing sales figures for the week with a local store manager who dropped by his hospital room. A drive shared by J. Willard Marriott, who lived by the motto, "Keep on being constructive and doing constructive things until it's time to die. Make every day count to the very end." Now, speaking of Sam Walton, I'm reminded of a story. On a warm day in the early 1990s, Mr. Walton drove around Phoenix with a Walmart regional manager. Now, at the time, Walton had bone cancer and only a short time remaining in his life. And yet, here he was, looking at store sites, checking out the competition, leading employees in the Walmart cheer. He had, at that moment, I think something on the order of $8 billion of net worth. Do the math. Something like a 4 years to live and $8 billion of net worth, he could probably make it to the end. And yet, there he was, still working, still building Walmart. Mr. Sam, the regional manager, finally asked him on that day, "Why do you keep going? Why don't you retire and enjoy life?" Walton turned, looked at him and snapped, and then said, "This is life." It's the same type of drive that led Walt Disney to bet its reputation on Disneyland with no market data to indicate the demand for such a wild dream. It's the type of drive that impelled Henry Ford to stake his whole future on the audacious goal, "We're going to democratize the automobile," and thereby leave an indelible imprint on the world. It's the type of drive that spurred Motorola to live by the motto, "Be in motion for motion's sake." Robert Galvin used the term renewal to describe Motorola's inner drive for progress. Renewal is the driving thrust of this company. Literally, the day after my father founded the company to produce B battery eliminators in 1928, he had to commence the search for a replacement product because the eliminator was predictably obsolete in 1930. He never stopped renewing. The drive for progress is never satisfied with the status quo, even when the status quo is working well. It's like a persistent and incurable itch. It's like a piece of stone inside your shoe. It just is constantly there, bothering you, driving you forward, irritating you, and it never goes away. It can never be satisfied under any conditions, no matter how successful you become. We can always do better. We can always go further. We can always find new possibilities. Like the core ideology, the drive for progress is an internal force. It comes from inside you. It doesn't wait for the external world to say, "It's time to change," or "It's time to improve," or "It's time to invent something new." No, it's like the drive inside a great artist or a prolific inventor. It is simply there, pushing outward and onward. Beethoven did not write the Ninth Symphony because the world said, "Ludwig, you should write the Ninth Symphony." He wrote it because it was inside him and he had to do it. Okay, now notice the dynamic interplay between core ideology on one hand and the drive for progress on the other. I mean, this is really the essence of the whole work. Core values provide continuity and stability, whereas on the other hand, the drive for progress urges continual change. The interplay between core and progress is one of the most important findings from our work. And in the spirit of the genius of the and, it doesn't seek a mere balance between core and progress. A great company seeks to be both highly ideological and highly progressive at the same time, all the time. The drive for progress and the core ideology exist together like the yin and yang. Each element enables, complements, and reinforces the other. The core ideology enables progress by providing a base of continuity around which a visionary company can evolve, experiment, and change. By being relentlessly clear about what is core, a company can more easily seek variation and movement in all that is not core. Key point. The secret to change is not to first ask what should change. The secret to change is to first ask, what do we stand for, and why do we exist? That should never change. and then to feel free to change everything else. And thus the drive for progress. It enables the core ideology, for without that continual change and forward movement, the company, the carrier of the core DNA, would fall behind in an ever-changing world and cease to be strong or perhaps even to exist. And the key thing to keep in mind here is that a great company doesn't just have intentions around their core values or this drive for progress. It actually institutionalizes them. It builds a set of tangible mechanisms to preserve the core, tangible mechanisms to stimulate progress. Look inside a visionary company and you'll see a ticking, bonging, humming, buzzing, whirring, clicking, clattering clock. You'll see tangible manifestations of its core and its drive for progress everywhere. You know, intentions, they're all fine and good, but it's the translation of those intentions into concrete items, mechanisms with teeth, that can make the difference between becoming a visionary company and forever remaining a wannabe. If you're involved in building and managing an organization, the single most important point to take away from this book is the critical importance of creating tangible mechanisms aligned to preserve the core and stimulate progress. This is the essence of clock building. What separated companies over 100 years into the truly iconic? They built tangible mechanisms to preserve their core values and to drive them towards their purpose, and they built tangible mechanisms to stimulate progress. This is the essence of it. This is the answer. This is 6 years of research distilled into one central idea. Now, in the chapters that follow, we will describe the specific methods and a number of the mechanisms for preserving the core and stimulating progress that distinguish the visionary companies, beginning with the idea of BHAGs, Big, Hairy, Audacious Goals. We encourage you to use our overall framework as a guide for diagnosing your own organization. Have you made the shift in perspective from time-telling to clock-building? Do you embrace the genius of and? Do you have enduring core values and purpose beyond just making money? Do you have a productively neurotic drive for progress, an almost primal urge for change and forward movement? And do you live the big idea of preserve the core and stimulate progress through tangible practices and mechanisms, such as big, hairy, audacious goals, homegrown management, and the others described throughout the remainder of this book? When you finish the next 6 chapters, you should have a sizable mental list of specific, tangible things you can do, you can implement to make your work or your company more visionary. You know, it really doesn't matter whether you're CEO or a division manager or a department manager or an individual contributor or a young entrepreneur, you can put these ideas to work. Chapter 5, Big, Hairy, Audacious Goals. Put yourself in the shoes of Boeing's management team in 1952. Your engineers have this idea to build a large jet aircraft for the commercial market. The problem is, your company has virtually no presence in the commercial market, and your earlier attempts to build a commercial plane have been failures. You've basically been building aircraft for the military. The B-17 Flying Fortress, the B-29 Super Fortress, the B-52 Jet Bomber. And 4/5 of your business comes from one customer, the Air Force. To make matters worse, your sales force is telling you that the commercial airlines in both the United States and Europe have expressed little interest in the idea of a commercial jet from Boeing. The airlines have a bias. Hey, you make great bombers up there in Seattle. Why don't you stick with that? No other aircraft company has proved that there is a commercial market for jet aircraft. Rival Douglas Aircraft believes that propeller-driven planes will continue to dominate the commercial market. And your company still has painful memories from layoffs, cutting the company from 51,000 employees down to 7,500 after the end of World War II. It's something you don't want to go through again. And then, for the clincher, your estimates show that it's going to cost about 3 times your average annual after-tax profit for the past 5 years, roughly a quarter of your entire net worth, to develop a prototype for the jet. Now, you think you've got a little bit of an advantage because you can take your KC-135 tanker, use the fuselage from that and adapt it to your new jet, but still, it's going to be a huge investment. Question is, what should you do? If you're Bill Allen and Boeing's management team, you defy the odds. You commit to the audacious goal of establishing yourself as a major player in the commercial aircraft industry. You build the jet. You call it the 707. And you bring the commercial world into the jet age. Now, at that exact same moment in history, the comparison company Douglas Aircraft, which later became McDonnell Douglas, made the explicit decision to stick with piston propellers and to take a cautious, well, we'll kind of wait and see approach to the commercial jet market. Douglas waited, and they saw Boeing fly right past and take dominant control of the commercial market. Even as late as 1957, the year, according to Business Week, that the airlines fell all over each other in their rush to replace piston planes with jets, Douglas still did not have a jet ready for the market. Finally, in 1958, Douglas introduced the DC-8, but it never caught up to Boeing. Now, you might be thinking, and it's a good question, wait a minute, maybe Boeing was just lucky. They look smart in retrospect, but it could have just as easily turned out wrong. And that's a good point. And we'd be inclined to agree except for one thing. For most of its history, Boeing had a long and consistent pattern of committing to big, audacious challenges. Looking as far back as the early 1930s, we see this bold commitment behavior at Boeing when it set the goal of becoming a major force in military aircraft, and it gambled its future on something called the P-26 military plane, and then it later bet the pot on the B-17 Flying Fortress. And this pattern didn't end in the 1950s with the 707. During the development of the 727 in the early 1960s, Boeing turned the demands of a potential customer, which was Eastern Airlines, into clear, precise, and nearly impossible challenges for its engineers. Build a jet that could land on runway 422 at LaGuardia, only 4,860 feet long, much too short for any existing passenger jet, and be able to fly nonstop from New York to Miami, and be wide enough for 6 abreast seating, and have a capacity of 131 passengers, and meet Boeing's high standards of indestructibility. Boeing's engineers made a significant breakthrough, the 727, largely because they were given no other choice. Then again, in contrast, Douglas Aircraft, the comparison in the study, was slow to respond and didn't introduce the DC-9 until 2 years after the 727. Putting it even further behind Boeing in the commercial jet market. And by then, Boeing had an even better short-range jet, the 737, then in development. Now, theoretically, Douglas could have risen to the Eastern Airlines challenge just as quickly as Boeing, but it didn't. In 1965, Boeing made one of the boldest moves in business history, the decision to go forward with the 747 jumbo jet, a decision that, in fact, nearly killed the company. At the decisive board of directors meeting, Boeing chairman Bill Allen responded to the comment by a board member that if the 747 program isn't panning out, well, we can always back out. Back out? Stiffened Allen, with just this icy tone in his voice. If the Boeing company says we will build this airplane, we will build it, even if it takes the resources of the entire company. As it had with the P-26, the B-17, the 707, and the 727, Boeing became committed to the 747 financially, psychologically, publicly. During the 747 development, a Boeing visitor commented, "You know, Mr. Allen, Boeing has a lot riding on this plane. What would you do if the first airplane crashed on takeoff?" After a long pause, Allen replied, "I'd rather talk about something more pleasant, like a nuclear war." Again, as with the DC-8 and DC-9, rivaled